Welcome to the Mid-Stage Startup Momentum Podcast. Each week, we interview up-and-coming founders of some of the fastest-growing mid-stage startups across the world. Your host is Roland Siebeling, who will share some of his own experience helping startups scale from 10 to 1,000 people in a few years. Here is Roland.
Hello and welcome to the Mid-Stage Startup Momentum Podcast. My name is Roland Siebeling and I'm a coach and ally to many of the fastest growing startups in the world. And today, one of the founders of one of those startups is with us. It's Maxime Lamotte-Brassard, the CEO and founder of Lima Charlie. Hello, Maxime. Thank you for joining.
I'm very happy to be here.
Yes, yes, it's good to have us both in the same time zone. Makes it a lot easier, right? So, Maxime, I got you on the podcast because Lima Charlie is one of the few companies that was able to raise some rounds recently. So tell us all about that, and then maybe you can also inform us, like, what does Lima Charlie do, and why were you able to get money where so many other founders are failing?
I think maybe it's easier to start with the, you know, what we do, and then, you know, clearly that eliminates a lot, you know, why we were able to do it. So Lima Charlie is in cybersecurity, which obviously is a, you know, it's a fairly hot kind of industry, right? There's a good amount of activity. We're taking a very different approach to most cybersecurity companies out there. So specifically, the theme of what we do is really around the evolution and maturity of cybersecurity. So specifically, we kind of had that realization that general tech went through a big shift in early 2000s that brought in the cloud age in tech. And, you know, I won't go kind of into all of the details, but the idea is that this was really driven by an increase in maturity in tech. And we're seeing the same kind of shift in cybersecurity, but nobody was taking this cloud approach to cybersecurity. So the approach of a cloud provider, which is really, really different than most vendors. So whereas most vendors in security are, you know, often we will refer to them as point products, right? So a single company built around a very single, you know, single product. And the whole thing is kind of behind that. Usually it has some acronym that was devised by Gartner so that, you know, people can understand it more easily. And so it's very driven in a single direction in that way. And what we're finding is that buyers in security are becoming a little bit tired because now they are having to deal with, you know, 50, 60, 70 different products over the year that they've had to buy because the industry's just been adding more and more acronyms, right? You need A and then enter the acronym. And so the cloud approach is kind of a rebase of that. You know, we're rebasing the industry in that we're saying a lot of those, you know, historical products that have existed for a decade now are not special anymore. They're becoming a commodity. So in other words, they're not a product or a company, they should be a feature.
Yeah.
And so we're building a cloud provider, but for cybersecurity primitives. So those core capabilities. And so we're building it like a cloud provider, right? Which has very different types of characteristics than, you know, if you're looking at a classic vendor, right? It's like comparing AWS to IBM.
Yeah.
Those two things are very fundamentally different. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we're doing. So it's a very different approach.
So if I may summarize my understanding, not being a security specialist whatsoever, really you're saying it's just like AWS offers all those kind of like server-like features, serverless features as they call them these days, in one big package and you can take them as you go. You try and do the same on the security front so that people don't have to install all these separate packages like they used to for when they had servers as well, right?
That's right. That's right. So we often talk about it in terms of Lego blocks, right? It's like having a bucket full of Lego blocks. How you assemble them, how you put them together will vary depending on who you are, what you're trying to accomplish. So we're taking that exact approach. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Very good. So that was enough of a proposition to get VCs to buy in?
So our fundraise history, right, is that in, I believe it was in 2019 or 2020 that we raised the pre-seed.
Yep.
and then raised the seed about, I think, about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we just raised our seed round. Sorry, our Series A.
Series A, congratulations. Yeah, and that's a very, very difficult step for many startups to overcome, right? How easy was it for you guys, if you can disclose, of course?
For sure. So it was fairly easy, but, you know, I don't want to make it sound like it was easy because, you know, we have something like completely, you know, magical. Like,
still a lot of work is what you're trying to say.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think really fundamentally the reason that it was fairly easy is that from the very beginning, we found investors that were interested in the vision that we were putting forward.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're taking a pretty different approach. It's a pretty different vision for better and for worse. And I'm sure we'll kind of get on that topic.
Yeah.
But it means that the investors that came with us on this journey, we're buying into this vision very clearly. So
mm-hmm.
we've been raising those three rounds. I mean, obviously, you know, new people have been coming in, but this latest round was mostly insiders, other than one new outside investor that we brought. And so I think it was a little bit easier because we didn't have to go and start from scratch, you know, purely on numbers, you know, trying to sell this vision to brand new investors. We were able to go and approach the people that have been with us for a while. They've been seeing the progress. You know, look, we grew a very nice amount. I think we 2.5x in this latest round. So, like, that's very nice.
Yeah.
And so I think it was just kind of a continuation of that. So we were questioning for a while because of the fundraising landscape whether we wanted to look for a bridge or, you know, how we wanted to play it. And one of our bigger investors, essentially, you know, we had that very frank discussion and said, you know, look, we're ready to help you raise a Series A. We think you're ready. And so we ended up just pulling the trigger and doing that.
Okay, excellent. So some vetted founders might say, oh, then you must have left money on the table by going for that preemptive. This must have crossed your mind, at least. I don't expect you to respond to the conclusion, but how do you kind of look at, you know, the balance between just getting the easier money that existing investors offer you versus doing the rounds and seeing if you can get more infusion or a higher valuation or both?
It's a brand new industry. It's really early on in the hype cycle. You know, which investor is truly going to be providing more value, et cetera. So we probably would have been shopping around a lot, right? Like in that situation. I think there's, you know, another situation which would be, you know, extreme growth, let's say. Look, if we'd done 10x in that previous round, then, you know, you really have the metrics to really, you know, makes you think twice about like going and really trying to optimize.
Then but you would have been able to get all the partners of the VC firms coming to San Diego to pitch to you, right?
pretty much. Now, in very truthfully, I don't know if we have been in that situation. I don't know if we would have picked any different investors. Mm. I really, really like our investors. And I think that puts us in kind of that, maybe not last, but that other category, which is, you know, we had good, easy, like good growth. But more importantly, we had the investors that were really heavily aligned. And
okay,
because our approach is different, there's one really big danger, which is it's less and less of an issue as time goes on. But this danger is to find an investor that is misaligned. So, you know, we could have easily found an investor that came to us and looked at our technology and said, hey, that one small corner of your technology, for us, it's the EDR. So the endpoint detection and response, it's a pretty valuable piece of cybersecurity technology.
Yeah.
And so early on, we had investors that were very interested in us, but they looked at us and said, hey, you have this EDR technology. You need to be an EDR company, you know, like pivot. This is the one thing you're going to do, you know, like, and I get it, right?
It's trying to focus on the one crown jewel in a sense.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. and then you get a much crisper communication and much mm-hmm. crisper message. The market already exists. It's already sized, right? So there's all these advantages. But for us, given our vision, I would classify that as a danger because, you know, I think there's a much bigger upside, a much more interesting upside in saying we will end up being the AWS of cybersecurity mm-hmm. in, you know, 5-10 years versus we will be one of 200 EDR companies fighting right. for the same, you know, area that's getting commoditized every day, right? So
yeah, so basically what you're illustrating is that even though venture capital is called risk capital, sometimes part of the job they try to do is to actually reduce the risk in their portfolio. And you're illustrating here, I think they're thinking that it's less risky to be one of the 200 EDR companies, even if the upside is limited, than to reinvent a whole category, right?
That's right. That's right. And it will vary, right? Like some investors are a lot more willing to take those risks. And yeah. I think that's who we're working with. And I think it also comes down to the willingness for an investor to, you know, to truly analyze the fundamentals of the idea. Right. Mm-hmm. To really kind of go through the thought process that led us to this idea of being a cloud provider for cybersecurity. And, it, you know, we didn't pick it randomly, obviously. And so there's a lot of market dynamics. And I think some investors feel a lot safer, you know, looking at a spreadsheet, having it all reduced to numbers and the numbers, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down. And so, yeah, different types of investors.
Maybe I can build on that because I think, of course, it's on the one hand, it's the risk versus reward profile, right? On the other hand, having been a founder many times myself, I think there's also this like, for you as a founder, what gives me energy versus like what's just boring? Right. And that's not just the spreadsheet side of things, because we all need spreadsheets for God knows, but it's more about like what drives you, what gives you energy is partially the reason why you become a founder, right? Like what's giving you that dopamine?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, I've worked at many different places in the industry. So I worked mm-hmm. at in government and intelligence, but also CrowdStrike and Google. And
yeah,
candidly, you know, if I was, you know, the ROI in terms of safety would probably make a lot more sense to be a Googler for the rest of my life.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's just not the temperament, I think, like mm-hmm. my personality.
So I wanted to take you through some of the typical questions we like to highlight in illustrating a little bit to our audiences how the company, the product, the role of the founder, etc., all changes as you mature as a startup, as you go through raising subsequent rounds of capital. So when you think about your whole go-to-market dimension, a lot of that must have been built up in the last two, three rounds, right? So looking back, how did you get started and where are you now and what changed over the years?
Oh my, a lot changed, obviously. So we used to be 100% inbound. So I think, so piece of context that's going to be helpful here is my background is as an engineer in security engineering, security operations.
Yeah.
My co-founder also has experience in early tech startups and technology and operations. So what we did not have was experience in sales and go to market. So pretty early, if, you know, early on, we were 100% inbound. We also didn't have marketing, obviously. And that was kind of the first side of things that we built up. And when I say we, I really mean as a company, you know, it was, you know, hiring the right people that knew what they were doing. And so we kind of grew this inbound, doing things like we have a podcast and, you know, going to conferences and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is where, I mean, still to this day, we've gotten the biggest amount of growth for us.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm.
So for us, the challenge and the change is in attempting to shift towards a method of growth where you have more control. Because, you know, let's call it out, it's great to have a lot of inbound growth. The risk with it is that understanding where the levers are is a lot harder.
Yeah,
you can't just say I made 10 calls and two of them came leads and then I got a contract.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in the middle of that shift towards trying to do more things outbound. And obviously, it's really more of a hybrid for us, because if you think in your mind, right, about a cloud provider, a big part of that value is assumed to kind of be inbound, meaning,
you know, BLG in a sense.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it was really important for us not to lose that side of the company. So yeah, we've been, I would say in the past 6 months, we've started hiring some folks to be a little bit more outbound in a strategic way, but it's an interesting shift because it just was not in our DNA.
Okay. And since you highlighted the background of both you and your co-founders as more technically oriented people, let's say, right? How do you feel in particular about founders having to sell the company themselves in the beginning versus hiring salespeople right from the outset?
I think it's a necessity. Yeah. Look, if my co-founder had been a somebody, you know, from sales in that industry, it wouldn't have been a necessity, because like I think, you know, the experience would have been there. We would have been able to start it earlier. But that being said, you know, I think unless your messaging is really, really, really simple, which I wish ours was, it's a requirement for the founders to figure it out, because nobody else is going to come in with your knowledge of the product, your knowledge of the type of market that you're trying to target. And if you can't communicate that, I think it's a non-starter, because, you know, the longer you wait and the people that you bring in, the further they're, I don't want to say disconnected, because that's a very negative way of saying it, but they're more distant to the fundamental, you know, messaging and drive that you are defining in your company. So you need to sort it out early so that you can start, you know, distilling it and making it simpler to digest for your own people internally, so that the more and more you grow, you know, it remains manageable to keep that growth.
I want to touch on two more points in the few more minutes that we have. One is, how far has your company grown and how has the culture evolved in terms of like the tone you set? Like, what were some of the key things you were telling early employees versus what you're telling them now to focus on, to keep in mind, core values to strive after?
I think that's one of the big change is, early on, we had to optimize how we hired for people that really wanted to be, there and believed the mission and, you know, wanted to build something, wanted to prove something. Because that's just the name of the game early on, right, in security. And so I think we very much did that. And now we're entering a phase where, you know, we still want some of this, but obviously, you know, it's just sort of the laws of physics, right? As you hire people, you have to have trust in the people that you've hired to go and then build under them. So that was, for me, that was one of the core things that I wanted to have as we grow, is for early employees to feel like they were building the company under them. Mm-hmm. And so I don't mean purely, you know, from an organization, right? But from a philosophy, from a way of working, because I think it makes all the difference. It makes all the difference pretty much at any point in your career when you have the opportunity to say, you know, I have ways that I think and beliefs, and I want to build the company that I want to keep working at. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that was a big thing. You know, communicating, keeping that message going is a challenge. It's the first time that I lived that challenge, right? Very candidly. Like, I've led teams in the past, but we've kind of reached now the point where the team is bigger than anything that I've led before. So I think we're kind of learning through this. And I mean, that's been my whole career, learning the hard way. And when you learn something the hard way, you truly learn it, versus having an influencer telling you, you know, the top five that you should be worried about.
Yeah, YouTube learning as opposed to real learning, right? Right. Very good. So you're talking about your own journey learning as a leader, right? And so it sounds like you have so much potential that there'll still be a lot of learning ahead there as well. But what changes have you already noted in your own style, maybe what you focus on, your own behavior, or how you calibrate a little bit, how you operate as a leader in your company?
Yeah, so that's changed quite a bit for me. As I mentioned, right, because I'm an engineer, it means that historically in the company, I've you know, been very, very heavily involved in engineering. Mm-hmm. And I still am. But the big change truly is for me to start replacing myself fully and that side of things. Mm-hmm. So it's a very new type of challenge, but I'm also very excited by it because at the end of the day, I do believe that learning is learning, right? So just different type of challenge at a different point in your career. I think the pitfall or the, you know, the big danger that I've always tried hard to avoid, and you know, I'm sure I've done good and not so good at different times, is if you're very comfortable with engineering, for example, in my case, it's very easy to focus on engineering problems.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the product is very important, but I think the rest of it is 80%. So finding the right way to message it to people, going and promoting the idea. So going to talk to different people about it, you know, teaching people that may not be thinking about it, thinking about, you know, where we want to promote it, right? Who are the right type of customers for us and who are not? So I think all of these things, it can be easy sometimes to kind of revert to just the thing that you're most comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that's been the biggest change, kind of forcing myself to go in and trying to think in terms of, you know, what's the messaging behind this events that we're doing?
Yeah.
Because as an engineer, it's a super weird thing.
Exactly. Okay, very good. Well, we've gone over time already because this was so interesting. So is there any last message you would want to share with our audience, those that have made it all the way to the end here?
Thanks for listening. I'm always happy to talk to folks. You know, if you're thinking of starting a company or starting a company and you just want to bounce ideas or thoughts or, you know, anything like that, I try to be as open to everybody as everybody that's helped me along the way. So don't hesitate.
Okay, excellent. And of course, we'll put your contact info to the degree you're comfortable in the show notes. And also any listener that knows me, I can introduce you to Maxime, you know, just to be in touch with me or with him directly. So thank you very much, Maxime Lamotte-Brassard, celebrating your Series A for Lima Charlie, an amazing accomplishment. And really thank you for a thoughtful interview.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Like what you heard? Subscribe to this podcast and leave a review. Tune in next time for more hot startups and interviews with some of the highest momentum startup founders in tech today.